Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to a new semester's series of. Are we bringing it down? We're going to try to get it down to a little more comfortable viewing level for you. Welcome to the first session of the University Colloquium for spring semester. I'm pleased to be able to introduce to you Jared Pfeiffer, who's the Assistant Professor of Management at the Zicklin School of Business at Baruch College in New York. I've known Jared for a little while. I had the privilege of reading his dissertation proposal and then his dissertation from the sociology department at Cornell, because I happened to be on a committee that was handing out dissertation awards, and Jared was the winner that year. Did a very interesting dissertation, a collection of studies on socially responsible investing, one of which had to do with Everence. So he's familiar with many of the institutions that many of us are familiar with as well. He's published quite a bit of work now in the area of socially responsible investing and the economic and social and moral issues that are associated with it. So I'm eager to hear what he has to say. After he finished his degree at Cornell in 2011, he was at Rice University in the Department of Sociology for a couple of years. Was it two, 3 years as a postdoctoral researcher, and then got the job at Baruch College in New York. This is the first, I think, that we've been able to entice him here to campus. So welcome, Jared. Looking forward to hearing what you have to say.
Thanks for that kind introduction, Fred, and I'm happy to be here. I was going to give you a little bit of the details that Fred just gave you, but to add to that a little bit so you have an idea of where I'm coming from and my background. I did my undergraduate work at Temple University, and I majored in economics and sociology there as an undergraduate. Went on to Cornell to get my PhD in sociology, but early on this economy and sociology interface was kind of forming back then. And then I did a postdoc at Rice with a professor of sociology of religion, and she really looks a lot at the interface of religion and science, Elaine Howard Eklund. My research is more at the interface of religion and the economy, or more broadly speaking, morality in the economy. So that was a formative time of my research as well at Houston. And now I'm in the management department at Baruch College, teaching courses in business and society, which touches a lot on business ethics. And I've been there for about a year and a half. I don't have any direct ties to EMU. I went to Lancaster Mennonite High School, so I know a lot of people that have come through here. It's a pleasure to be here and share with you some of my research. Right now, I would say that also working in Manhattan is where Baruch is. My family, my wife and two daughters live in North Jersey in West Orange, New Jersey. So that's where we're living right now. Okay, so as you can see, the title of my talk is The Morality of Socially Responsible Investing. So to get us started, I think it's helpful to couch my research as an interest in how people meld together morality with their money. Okay, so kind of in broad strokes, that's the kind of stuff I'm interested in studying. And I want to show a quick cartoon here from Christianity Today. Give you a chance to read it. You see the guy praying earnestly to God, just give me some inside information on the stock markets and I'll kick back 20% for worthy charities. 1985, 20% is about what you could get in the stock market, actually. But I give this an example. This is one way we can meld together morality and money, and the fact that I got a couple chuckles out there, thank you, suggests that maybe it's not the most legitimate way in most of our minds that we would mix together morality and money. But there are many ways to do it, and that's kind of what my research is interested in focusing in on. So a quick outline of what I'll be covering today. First, I'll talk a bit about a social scientific approach to the study of morality. Talk a little bit about socially responsible investing, and then I'm going to give you two studies that I've done in this vein. The first is a survey of Praxis investors. That's the Mennonite Everence Praxis Mutual Funds. This is a paper from my dissertation, just got published last year. If anyone wants to read it, send me an email. I'll be happy to send you a copy. So this was from a number of years back, and then I also want to share you some recent research that I'm doing, an online experiment that I just ran a couple months ago, and I'm analyzing the data right now. I'm getting ready to send this paper out to submit it. So I'll give you the results from that experiment. All right, so the topic of morality in the market. I think what brings me to this topic and what makes it interesting to me is, as I mentioned, I was an economics major at Temple University, and you quickly learn from economics that they have neoclassical economics brings a very particular assumption to the study of economic behavior, okay? And you can sum this up with the idea of homo economicus, if you've heard of that term before. It's a rational economic man is what it means. So it's an assumption of a caricature of a social actor that is rational, logical, looks at the world as a set of cost-benefit analyses that you want to get the right payoff, and then you choose the one that optimizes your payback, okay? So it's like this computer making decisions like that. So people from this tradition make that assumption, and then they plug through and they do their research to figure out how people are making their economic decisions. And it very much relies on a self-interested actor, a person that's interested in maximizing their output, their outcome. Now, Adam Smith also adds a nice nuance to this that is central to a lot of economic thought as well. So this is a famous quote from Adam Smith, 1869, who was helped originate the discipline of economics. He writes, "It's not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we expect our dinner, but from their regard to their own interest." Okay? And so he also argues that the invisible hand of the market comes in. When everyone's looking out after their own self-interest, it just turns out that society benefits, that that's the best outcome for society when everyone is self-interested. And I think this is really an important ideological foundation for modern rational capitalism as we know it. This is an idea that people can say, it's okay for me to be self-interested in the market. And in a sense, it justifies greed. And I want to be careful about saying that, because I certainly think greed existed before capitalism came around, but I think what capitalism did is it helped provide a justification to be greedy, and that didn't exist before. That now we have a clever way to say, by me being greedy, looking out for my own self-interest, this is what makes the economy churn, this is what makes it vibrant, okay? So I think that's one side effect of this school of thought. And it also suggests that benevolence does not belong in the market. So benevolence might be another word for morality. And so it's kind of pushing out, morality doesn't really operate in the market. What we see is self-interest. Okay, so this is partially a description of what's happening, and it's partially assumptions to kind of go forward with your research. But I think it's also instrumental in shaping how we experience our experience in the market. All right, so the punchline here in my own research agenda, I'm interested in better understanding how morality does exist in the market. So this is kind of setting up some assumptions out there when people come to the study of the economy, and I'm saying, yeah, self-interest is important in the economy, but I think morality also plays a role, and I hope to better understand how morality does play a role in what's happening in the market. So what do I mean by morality? Broadly speaking, right, we could spend a whole semester talking about morality and the study of the morality and what it is and what it's not. But I think it's helpful to orient ourselves to say, when I think of morality, I'm thinking of something that pertains to the right thing to do. Okay? Right, there's good, there's bad, and we make statements about what is good and what is bad. When you hear the word ought, or when you start thinking in terms of ought, that's a kind of a signal to me that we're talking about some moral statements now. Right? So I think me and my family ought to live simply. That's kind of a moral value for me, and I would be maybe willing to encourage other people to do the same. I've had a beard for about 15 years now, but I don't think I ought to have a beard, and I wouldn't say that other men should have beards as well, right? That's not a moral value for me. That's something different. So that's generally what I mean by morality. And there's a couple different ways of thinking about that. One would be a more prescriptive or normative approach to morality. This is what theologians often are in the business of doing, more philosophers. And even if you think about your Sunday school conversations, where we're wading right in there and we're saying what we think is good and bad and how we ought to live and how we ought not to live, those kinds of conversations, we're very familiar with those kinds of conversations. As a sociologist, I take a step back from that, and I'm not in the conversation, I'm listening to that conversation, and I'm starting to understand, why does that person always talk about consequentialist kinds of morality? What's happening there? I wonder why they talk like that. And that person has this other way of bringing his or her moral values to the discussion. So I'm stepping back and I'm giving a descriptive approach about what morality is. And so that's very much what I'm doing today. I'm looking at how morality is driving people to behave in certain ways. All right, so in lieu, with that being said, Chris Smith has a book from 2003, and it's a nice title, is Moral Believing Animals. And I like this because it just assumes, it asserts that individuals are moral creatures. We go about the business of making moral statements and living by them and encouraging others to do the same. This is a very different kind of assumption than the homo economicus assumption that I talked about earlier. So this is kind of where I'm starting from, right? In addition to this assertion that we are all moral creatures, morality can be a pretty strong social factor as well. And we don't have to look any further than our own faith tradition. This is a picture from Martyr's Mirror, where indeed people are willing to go to the stakes out of their moral beliefs, their religious beliefs. So this can be a really strong factor driving us to behave in certain ways. And so I'm just saying, does morality impact our economic decisions? And if so, how does it do that, right? We see that it can be very strong in these realms of life. Is it an equally strong realm when we're making investment decisions? Okay, that's kind of the question that I'm interested in. Not ought it be an important decision, but is it? In descriptively, is that what's happening? Another helpful tool in this descriptive approach to morality, I borrow Jonathan Haidt's work. He's a psychologist and a moral psychologist, and he argues there are five, maybe six, universal moral foundations. And what he means by this is that across time and across cultures, there's kind of this stable set of moral foundations that drives people's moral behavior. So one of these moral foundations is harm care. So this is the idea you might think of as altruism, the impulse to help other people, to reduce harm, to help other people, altruistic concerns. I think that's a familiar kind of morality that makes sense to us. Fairness and cheating, you can look at our little ones. I have a 5-year-old daughter, and she has kind of this innate sense of what's fair and what cheating is, right? There's some kind of moral belief about what is fair, and that's also an important one that drives our moral perceptions. Loyalty and betrayal, this is really referring to in-group loyalty, so these obligations to take care of the people within your own in-group and be loyal to the people that are close to you. You can think of an ugly side to this, because that conversely means you're not being so nice to people outside of the group, but nonetheless, this is a kind of a universal moral value that people have. Authority, subversion, this refers to obeying people in your own hierarchical structure. So if you're in a system, you need to obey your authority, that's it. You know, that's a certain kind of morality, too, that we see across cultures, across time. And lastly, sanctity and degradation. This is an impulse to remain pure, and I see this idea that there's something sacred out there and we don't want it to be defiled by things that would make it dirty. Okay, so in many cultures, you wouldn't dream of entering someone's house without taking your shoes off, because you're bringing all the contaminants from the street and you're bringing it into their sacred living room area, right? So there's this sense that would be immoral to do that in that context. We don't really have that sense in the U.S. Many times I walk into people's houses with my shoes on, but that's an example of kind of that moral foundation. This work has spun off some interesting research. Particularly, he's interested in understanding the culture wars in America, and so that's partly what he was thinking about when he developed this. And studies since then have found that political conservatives tend to rank high on all five of these moral foundations. So there's a way to measure each of your individual characteristics, how you rank each of these things, but through a variety of survey questions. So conservatives tend to rank high on all five of them. Political liberals rank high on care, harm, and fairness and cheating. And they rank pretty low when it comes to loyalty, authority, and sanctity. Okay, so there's that predictable pattern across the aisle here, which I think is helpful. It gets us away from saying that group over there is being immoral, and we change our way of thinking about it, and that group is being moral in a particular way. Let me understand what they're thinking about, and brings out a more empathetic part of ourselves than kind of casting them as being the immoral group. So I think that's an interesting way this research has spun and has helped me in thinking about those things. All right, so I'm going to come back to this in both of my studies as how this would be applied to socially responsible investing. But before that, I want to give you a quick introduction to what socially responsible investing is. I focused on mutual funds because I'm interested in how average Americans bring their morality to bear in their monetary decisions, as opposed to institutional investors who also engage with socially responsible investing. I'm thinking about mutual funds, the things that you invest in for your retirement. About half of American households invest in a mutual fund right now. So there's about 8,000 mutual funds in the U.S. that you can choose from. About 2% of these are socially responsible mutual funds. It's a pretty narrow corner of the market. What is an SRI fund? The one thing nearly all SRI funds do is they screen out corporate stock that they think is immoral or something that they just don't want to touch. They don't want to invest in it. The colloquial sin stocks, this is starting back from the 70s, were gaming, alcohol, and tobacco. A lot of these mutual funds did not invest in these kinds of stocks. They just screened them out. Okay, so now the SRI community screens something out. The criteria change from fund to fund. The environment is a really important criteria right now, but the general form of SRI can be filled with any moral content you choose. I interviewed a guy from the Christian Science Church. They don't invest in the pharmaceutical industry because of the belief of spiritual healing, right? So they have whatever moral beliefs you have, you could just say, I'm not going to invest in it. I'm not going to touch it. Some mutual funds also are engaged in advocacy work. So this is something where you own the corporation and you're dialoguing with management to try to change behavior for the better. You can do that by getting a meeting with the CEO and speaking with him or her, or using your shareholder voting rights. That's another way that advocacy is taking place in the SRI realm. And least frequently practiced among SRI funds is community investments. This is where the money's deliberately invested in like a pot of money that is helping the community. So maybe it's a pot of money for entrepreneurs who wouldn't get access to regular banking. They get that money to start their job. And so that's literally giving them the money and hoping to get a return on your investment. Okay, so now I'm gonna move into the two studies part of my presentation here. So just to give you a snapshot of where I'm going with this. In the first study, the two questions I'm asking are socially responsible investors more loyal to their funds? And what kind of SRI investors are more loyal? And I'll give you more details as we go along. The second study is an online SRI experiment that I should mention. I'm co-authoring with a grad student at Baruch, Jing Liu. So she's been very helpful in this research. The question we ask here is, what type of morality drives different types of investors to invest in socially responsible investment vehicles? Okay, so first we go to praxis. This was my dissertation research. I did some interviews out in Goshen, speaking with people that run Praxis. At that time, it was Mennonite Mutual Aid, MMA. So that's their old logo. And now they've transferred to Everence, is their new name. But that happened before I was there. This is associated with the Mennonite denomination. I'm often giving this talk to non-Mennonites, and I just tell them they are well-known in the SRI community. If you talk to people in the SRI realm, they've heard of those Mennonites that do advocacy, and they've been at the table. Everence has been at the table since 1994, which is towards the beginning of the SRI kind of taking off a little bit in the U.S. What makes Praxis distinct is the military screens. So they don't invest in any military-related stock. I interviewed the guy that runs the bond fund. He's not able to invest in U.S. bonds because they reason that that money gets channeled back into the defense industry one way or another. So that's one thing out of his toolkit that he has to try to keep up with the bond market without being able to invest in U.S. treasuries. So some SRI funds only do the screening out part. MMA, Praxis is heavily engaged in advocacy. Okay, so they are at the table with some of the corporations that they own and trying to change the behavior for the better. Okay. Okay, so after the interviews at Praxis, I said I really would love to get do a survey of Praxis investors. I'm interested in getting at individual level, people that invest their money, what is their perspective? And so I was given permission to do a survey of Praxis investors. So I got some funding to do this professionally. I had a survey firm that trained people to sit behind a computer and call people up through their headset and chug through the interview. So this happened in January and February 2010. Is when the survey took place. When I was setting it up with a survey firm there at Cornell, we had guessed with how much money I had and how quickly this stuff normally happens. We were thinking maybe we'll get a sample size of 300 because they're used to most people saying, I don't feel like talking to you and hanging up. You got to figure that in. Well, it turns out we got 502 completed interviews, and they kind of told me in the side, like, wow, these group, they're usually willing to talk to us for 20 minutes out of their evening. It was kind of surprising to them that they had such an acquiescent group. But this ought to better for me because the bigger sample size, the better from my perspective. So we had 502 completed interviews. The response rate was 62%, which is quite good for survey research. You can publish in 15-20% range. So this obviates your concern of non-response bias when you have a bigger response rate. All right, so I'm going to get right into the data here and kind of set up some of the questions that I'm going to answer with these data. This first pie graph is representing the fact that some practice investors also invest in conventional mutual funds. And what I mean by conventional is non-SRI. So your Fidelity, your American Fund, your TIAA, something that is not doing any social criteria, but it's just trying to get the best return based on whatever financial criteria they've set up. So about 40% of Praxis investors are what I call dual investors. They invest in both Praxis and a conventional fund. The remaining 62% are only invested in Praxis and or another SRI fund, okay? This is actually, 62% was higher percentage than I was kind of expecting to find. But the reality is there are many people that I like to call morally diversified, right? They say they want to invest in an SRI fund, but in reality, they also own that Vanguard index fund, which inevitably puts them in military stocks, in environmental, in all those issues that they're trying to avoid with their SRI fund. They're also likely invested in these other funds. I think that's just a reality of the SRI sector in the U.S., although this really suggests that maybe a lot of SRI investors are only invested in SRI. I don't know how that would generalize beyond the Mennonite case here. All right, so I'm going to focus on this dual investor group to answer my first research question. And I'm not going to go into all the theoretical motivation here, but basically I think it's not hard to set up the expectation that due to the moral components of SRI investments, the screening, the advocacy, the fact that there's this additional social component, I'm predicting that's going to make the assets a little stickier. People are going to hold on to their SRI mutual funds longer than they would their conventional mutual funds because there's a moral impulse to continue to invest in them. It's not just about return performance when you're talking about SRI. Okay, so that's my argument. And that leads to the hypothesis that these dual investors, I expect to be more loyal to their Praxis funds than to their conventional funds. Okay? By loyal, I basically mean they're going to hold on to those assets longer. They're more loyal. So here's the question that I ask the respondents. In the past, have you ever sold shares from your Praxis mutual funds because of low return performance? And that's a yes or no question. People told me, yes, I did. No, I did not. About 14 questions later in the same survey, I ask, in the past, have you ever sold shares from your conventional mutual fund that you just told me that you own because of low return performance? So within each individual, I have these two survey questions that allow me to get at this question, which group of mutual funds were more frequently sold and which were held onto more. So here's the univariate results here. What this says is that among the conventional funds that these people own, 32% said they had sold their conventional funds in the past because of low return performance. Only 16% had sold their Praxis fund in the past because of low return performance. Okay? So the punchline here is dual investors, from the way I'm measuring it here, are more loyal to their Praxis fund than their conventional fund. There's fewer of these Praxis funds churning than we do but compared to the conventional funds. Now, in the paper, I have a lot of covariates in the model to control for other predictors of this dependent variable. I control for how many funds of each they own, because it could be that if you just own more conventional mutual funds, the likelihood of you of having sold one of them would increase. But I control for that in the model and still find that this is a robust finding. So dual investors are more loyal to their Praxis fund. So this kind of suggests to me that morality really is helping the assets become a little bit more sticky. And this confirms some of my prior research where I look at a broader set of mutual funds than just Praxis. All right, the second research question I want to share today is, what factors are associated with this fund loyalty that I'm just talking about here? So here I'm going to use the full sample, not just the dual investors, but everyone that invests in Praxis. I don't need to make that comparison with this question. So I measure loyalty a bit differently, but it's kind of the same process here. I ask all the respondents, if you were to learn that the return performance of your Praxis fund was usually lower than conventional funds, how likely is it you would sell some shares of Praxis for that reason? Okay, so this is kind of an attitudinal question. People kind of give me a sense of whether that's likely or unlikely. And we see here that about 60% say extremely unlikely, not at all likely that I would sell, even if I were to learn that I was getting lower returns. So what I'm saying is this group of 60% represents what I call a loyal investor, someone that says I'm in this even if the return performance is lower. And so the next step here, this is my dependent variable. The next step is look for independent variables that help me predict this outcome. Okay. And so I'm going to show you some of those independent variables that I look at, and I'm not going to make all the formal predictions here, but I have a hunch that this should help me explain variance in this outcome. And then I'll show you the results. So you invest in Praxis maybe because your employer said you can invest in it, but you had no idea that it was an SRI fund, right? That's possible. I asked the question, did you know that Praxis is engaged in screening? And I kind of defined what screening was. I didn't just use that terminology. 90% of my sample said yes. I knew that Praxis was screening out probably military stocks. Most people probably know that. So no surprise there, but I was a bit more surprised to find that even though Praxis is heavily engaged in advocacy work, only 54% of the sample were aware of that at all, right? So there's a lack of knowledge. They don't even know that Praxis is engaged in advocacy work. I shared these results at Everence, and Mark Regiers, if any of you know him, whose lifetime has been spent doing this advocacy work, you know, kind of threw his hands up and said, you know, this is what he suspected, but it's depressing to learn that even though they're advertising and they're trying to get the word out, it's still nearly half the sample doesn't even know that he's doing this work. All right, coming back to the moral foundations that I talked about, I'm arguing that this screening impulse to keep away the things that are the sin stocks, the dirty stocks, is really tapping into a purity sanctity kind of morality. This impulse to remain pure, and to an extent, what screening affords us is the ability to say that we have a pure investment portfolio, right? That whatever you think is going to defile your investment portfolio, it's just not there. And I'm also arguing that the advocacy is tapping more into the harm care moral foundation. So this, by engaging management in dialogue, you're hoping to make the world a better place. You're engaging with this corporation, and you're hoping that stakeholders all around that corporation will benefit from you changing their behavior. So the fact is, screening out may or may not change behavior, but what screening does most proximately is make you feel like you can at least sleep well at night. And some of the interviewees that I talked with mentioned that. I feel like I have a clean conscience when I invest with Praxis because I know I'm not investing in things that I would disagree with. So I'm going to come back to that, but I think this helps. There's two different kinds of moral foundations that could really be enlivening people's interest in SRI investments, and I'm interested in which one that is. And I'll come back to this in my second study as well. Okay, so that's one set of independent variables. Another one is simply the perception of return performance that investors have. So I asked them, do you think MMA Praxis tends to earn lower returns than most conventional funds, about the same level or higher returns than most conventional funds? About half the sample said same. About a third said they thought they're getting lower returns by investing with Praxis. 7% thought they were getting higher returns. Okay, so you'll see that I would expect that the people that think they're getting higher returns are going to be more loyal to their funds, or conversely, the people that think they're getting lower returns would be less loyal. That's kind of the prediction I'm making here, because I realize that self-interest plays a role here as well. It's not all about just a moral motivation. There's also a self-interest. I need to get a return on my investment, and this is kind of tapping into that part of people's motivation as well. Okay, here we are. So this is ordered logistic regression. See at the bottom there, I've included a number of covariates that I'm not presenting right now. I just want to show you the hypothesized effects. So knowledge of screening and advocacy at the top here. When you don't see the asterisks, that means there's no statistically significant effect. And so neither knowing screening or knowing about the advocacy makes any difference in terms of the dependent variable, which again is fund loyalty, that group of people that say they were not at all likely to sell even if they got lower returns. After I asked about knowledge, I said, okay, now you know about screening if you didn't before. How important is that to you? Many people already knew about screening, so that wasn't always the case. But they could rank how important screening was on a scale from 1 to 7. So for some people, very important that Praxis does screening on my behalf. Some people rank it a 2. That's not important to me. That's not why I'm investing with Praxis, right? So I get variance in that dimension. It turns out that people that highly value screening are more loyal to their fund than people that don't value screening. And so I'm getting some traction here with that value screening. I'm not getting any traction with the valuing of advocacy work. Okay, so I am measuring variance in how valuable advocacy work is, but it doesn't help me predict my dependent variable, right? So it's not statistically significant. This is a way, when we see an odds ratio of 2.2, that really means nothing. So this is a way to interpret that in a way that makes sense to us. People in the yellow bar here, is it yellow for you? Greenish yellow. People that highly value screening have a 68% predicted probability of being that loyal investor. People that don't value it highly only have a 50% predicted probability. So that's a difference of about 20 percentage points, and that's substantial. I mean, that's something that raises your eyebrow when you see it. Okay, perception of return performance. My referent category here is the people that said they think they're getting about the same returns from Praxis as they do from conventional funds. And what we find here is that people that think they're getting lower returns are less loyal compared to that referent group, okay? So there is a statistically significant difference there. Let me just show you here in predictive probabilities. You see the bar here on your left is the lowest. The other two are about 63, but the people that say they're getting lower returns are less loyal to their fund. Okay, so again, that's kind of what I expected to find. It is interesting that about the same and higher returns group are no different from one another. They're about the same. So if you can convince people that you're going to get the same return performance, that's about as good as you can get as far as hoping people continue to invest in it. I asked people how much of a sense of belonging they have to the Mennonite tradition, to the Mennonite church. And some people feel like they really are part of the community, and some people feel like they're less of the community. But this didn't help me predict any variance in my outcome, and I had some predictions that that should. When you feel like you're part of a group, you're gonna, that in-group loyalty kind of thing, you're gonna stick with that group, but it didn't come out in this analysis. And then I tested for a network effect, so I said, do you talk with your friends and family about Praxis, yes or no? And I got variance on that. Some people did, some people did not. This coefficient of less than one in this analysis means it decreases the odds. So let's be clear here. People that do talk about Praxis with their friends and family are less loyal to their Praxis fund, to the Praxis fund than those that do. The people that do not talk have a higher probability of falling into that loyal category. So it's a little surprising to me to find that. I assumed that when you're talking it up with your friends, that would be a reason to continue invest in it. I'll give you an interpretation of that in a second, what might be happening here. All right, so I quickly want to summarize the results that we just went through. You know, one of the central questions is what kind of morality is at play among Mennonites when it comes to SRI investing? And from my results, I find that screening matters, that highly valuing the screening function of Praxis did help me predict who was more loyal. Advocacy did not help me predict it. So the interpretation is that the purity, sanctity, moral foundation is a stronger driver of socially responsible investing among Mennonites than that harm care kind of advocacy moral foundation. Perception of low return performance decreases fund loyalty. It's important to recognize morality and return performance matter, right? So I'm making a case morality matters. Let me see how it does. All the time I realize that self-interest and how much money you're getting is also part of the picture, and this comes through with this finding. And about the network effects, one way to interpret this is perhaps there's more negative Praxis chatter around our Mennonite potlucks than any kind of positive chatter about Praxis. I don't know if that rings true with you all or not, but if people are saying bad things about Praxis, that would make sense that when they're talking about it, people are getting a negative impression of Praxis. But I did interviews with people, and I never got that kind of qualitative support for this interpretation. But nonetheless, when people, you know, from my quantitative work here, the people talk about it, those are the ones that are less loyal to the fund. All right, so I'm going to move on here to my second study. Again, this is one that I'm kind of in the throes of right now. The question we are asking here is, and this is closely related to the work that I just shared with you, what type of morality drives different types of investors to invest in their socially responsible investment vehicles? So what I'm going to do is couch SRI investment option in different kinds of moral language and see how that gets people excited about investing in SRI or not. Should say also I'm moving beyond the Mennonite case study to a more representative sample of Americans, which I think is an important part to see how this really is operating in a larger scale. So I have a sample of about 1,000 investors and non-investors, average Americans. I get this sample from Amazon Mechanical Turk, which is a crowdsourcing way that a lot of researchers now are finding people to take their surveys. This is legitimate if you're doing an online experiment. If you want to make generalizable statements about the American population, this is not a representative sample, right? This is people that sign up for an internet study and get paid a little money on the side to do that. But a lot of experiments come out of undergraduate labs in psychology departments. So how generalizable is that to a general population? I mean, so we're getting a little more representative, I think, by doing this kind of work. But by no means am I making generalizations about the American population, because I don't have a properly random sample that you want to do that. All right, so everyone's reading this investment scenario that I made up, and then they're asked to allocate a percentage of the retirement funding to social funds and a conventional fund. So pretend you only have two options when your employer gives you a hand, something to fill out and say how much you want to invest in each. So that's kind of, I'm running through that kind of process with them, and people can indicate what percentage they would allocate to this social fund that they just read about, okay? Now, the key manipulation in this experiment is I'm varying what social fund each of these people reads about, okay? So there's four categories here. I'm randomly assigning people into each of these pots. So you get to read one description of your social fund, and here's what they read. And I should mention that this is really kind of two different studies, one just for screening, and then at the bottom there's an advocacy study. So for the screening study, some people are randomly assigned to read this. Sage Invest Social Fund. So I made that term up. Does that sound like a good mutual fund? Sage? Sage Invest Social Fund avoids ownership in stock of corporations that have failed to meet certain social, human, and environmental criteria. Okay, so it's just talking about the avoiding part of socially responsible investing. It doesn't talk about advocacy at all, which is fine. Most people don't even know about this, so I'm just feeding them the information that I want them to read about. And I'm intentionally not using any moral language, and I'll tell you what I mean by that in a second. So this is the moral screening condition. And here I have in boldface words, these are words that Jonathan Haidt says primes these kinds of moral foundations that I'm interested in priming, and this is the purity sanctity one. Okay? So Sage Invest Social Fund avoids ownership in the stock of dirty corporations that fail to meet certain social, human, or environmental criteria. Since this mutual fund is not tainted, investors can maintain a more wholesome and pure investment portfolio. So I'm just kind of hitting them over the head with this moral terminology. And this is what you're supposed to do in this kind of research, because people read it so quickly and it's, you know, they don't know. I don't have it in boldface for sure. This is just, it jumps out at you. But I even think I wasn't strong enough. If I had to do this over again, I think I would spend more time just making sure, like, do you get it? Do you get it that I'm talking about purity, sanctity right now? But this is what they read, okay? So the only difference here is this has moral language, that doesn't up there. They're both describing the screening part of a mutual fund, right? I do the same thing for this advocacy study at the bottom. Sage Invest actively encourages corporations in its investment portfolio to meet certain social, human, and environmental criteria. Here's the harm care language that I pour on. Sage Invest actively encourages abusive corporations that meet certain criteria. By dialoguing with management of harmful corporations, this mutual fund hopes to benefit a variety of people and create a more caring society. Okay, so those are harm care words. A lot of research uses this kind of language to prime this kind of thing. If this resonates with you as a harm care person, my prediction is you're going to invest more in this bottom one than if you were exposed to that advocacy control condition. So here are the hypotheses, basically what I just said. If you're exposed to the condition that describes SRI investment screening activity with purity sanctity words, you're going to allocate more to that investment than to the control condition. And the same with the second study, the advocacy study. Okay, so I'll get right to the results here. Let's just look at the two bars at the left right now, because these are really two separate studies. So about 250 people were exposed to that screening control, 250 to moral screening. We see a bigger bar there on the right, so the moral screening language, the purity sanctity language, maybe boosted their investments over there, but this is actually not a statistically significant difference. If I would have done this study 1,000 times, these bars would have been going up and down, and I don't get any consistent response to what's happening here. So this is not a statistically significant difference, even though it looks like it's a difference. And it's only 30 versus 0.7%. It's not a large, substantial difference. So this fails to support my hypothesis. I predicted that this moral screening would give substantial, people would pile on because this language is important reason why people invest in these funds, and I'm not finding support for that. So that kind of doesn't mix with the Mennonite results that I was finding, where there it was the screening, the purity sanctity kind of thing that I think was at play, but I'm not finding support for that here. Now, the second study, we see a bigger difference. People that did read about the moral advocacy language invest about 35 5%, say they would allocate 35% to that social fund, the rest would go to the conventional fund versus 31.7. That is a statistically significant difference. Okay, so I do find support for that second hypothesis that harm care couched with advocacy is getting people more excited about SRI investments. I should say that I'm just showing the univariate results here. I control for a number of covariates underneath this analysis as well, and this statistically significant difference remains after controlling for a number of things, gender, political ideology, income, a variety of things that might conflate what's happening here. All right, so the additional wrinkle I add to this is, well, does this experimental effect vary by one's religiosity, how religious people are, and there's I'll show you how I measure that. So you can make the prediction. In fact, most people, when they hear about purity sanctity for the first time, you're often going to religious imagery to explain how that kind of morality gets going. So religious rites of purity, sacred and holy, these are words that often swirl around a religious context. And so I'm working on this in the paper right now. I need to put more work into giving that theoretical motivation for this hypothesis, but I'm pretty sure I can come up with this generating this hypothesis, which is moral screening effect should be especially strong among religious Americans. Okay, so I'm predicting an interaction effect, and I'll tell you in a second exactly what that means, but that's what I'm doing if you're familiar with regression analysis. Likewise, religion and the golden rule. Nearly every religion has some version of the golden rule to help other people, and so I'm arguing religions espouse compassion, care for other people, do unto others as you would have them do to you. So I'm arguing that moral advocacy effects should also be especially strong among religious Americans. All right, so I'm going to show you, I do find support for both of those hypotheses. This is showing, again, predictive probabilities, but I'm varying the religiosity of each individual. So the way I measure religiosity here is I just say, how religious are you? Not at all religious, somewhat religious, moderately religious, or very religious. Okay, so a very simple kind of, I let people interpret for themselves where they rank in that Likert scale. So the steepest line here, the 29 to 37, that is the very religious group of people. So if you're exposed to the screening control condition, you're only given 29. If you're a very religious person exposed to the moral screening condition, you're giving the highest amount there, 37.3. So that basically means that experimental effect that I'm looking for is strongest among people who are most religious. Conversely, if you're in that red group and you say you're not religious at all, it doesn't matter what condition you are exposed to. You're both giving about 35%. Okay, so the experimental effect does not exist among people who are not religious. They are mute to the moral language would be another way of saying that, but when you give the moral language to a very religious group, it resonates with them and it changes their behavior. That's kind of what these results are suggesting. And I basically find the identical picture in the second experiment where I'm looking at advocacy. When you pour on the harm care language to that description, we're seeing that really does boost interest among the very religious. It doesn't boost interest among the people who are not at all religious. Okay, so that's suggesting that this experimental effect varies by religiosity. All right, so that's just a snapshot of some of the stuff I'm finding with this experiment. As with all experiments, some of my predictions are not met, but there's some interesting findings I think here nonetheless. So, as a summary of the studies that I talked about today, you know, one basic question I have: does morality make a difference in investment behavior? And I find some evidence that it does. You could be cynical and say it doesn't make as big of a difference as you think. Look at that 2% percentage that I told you. Only 2% of mutual funds are socially responsible. So what's up with that? Why is that such a small number if we think morality is strongly in getting people to invest in the market? You know, that would be evidence that it's not very strong. Nonetheless, I'm finding some evidence here that morality does make a difference. Another question is, why does it make a bigger difference? And by exploring this, I can get answers to that kind of question as well, by understanding how it does work and how it might not make a difference. Which moral foundation matters more? I think what's interesting about the SRI case is that you could really argue two different kinds of moral foundations are getting people excited about it. So among the Mennonites, I find that it seems like the purity sanctity is more important among the Mennonite sample that I look at. But among the broader sample of Americans, I find that the action's more at the harm care the advocacy and the harm care is what is making people more interested in that SRI investment opportunity, and the purity sanctity language doesn't really make a difference in my experiment. And that both experimental effects are stronger among religious Americans. That's something I want to explore a little bit further, but I think it kind of intuitively makes sense. Being part of a religious institution just sensitizes us to these kind of moral, it's kind of our, we're used to that language and we're more receptive to it, perhaps, something like that. All right, so I want to come up to the kind of the big picture here. Every good presentation starts with big questions like an hourglass. It gets into the details, and now I need to come back out at the bottom and kind of give a big picture takeaway from my study. And this was kind of hard for me to do, but I guess I would say in closing, I think we need to know more about how morality is driving economic behavior. That's where my research lies, and why do I think that? The larger role morality plays in the market, the more humane our market will be. So I'm in a business school right now, and if all we teach our students is that people are self-interested in the markets, well, that's a justification for the managers to turn out and be self-interested and think that morality is just something on the sides that doesn't matter. So I think by bringing a sharper understanding of how morality does matter in the market and teaching that and getting that word out, I think that could make a difference in kind of the overall humanity of our market system. And it's not necessarily my goal that everyone goes home and feels guilty that they don't invest more in socially responsible investing. That's not really my interest. I think anytime you get people in a room that are starting to think more critically about how they meld their moral and their economic lives together, I think that's really what my interest is, to be thinking about that, because I think our market system so easily pushes those things to the side, and we have justification to say, well, I can't think about moral things because I need to get the best return on my investment, or I need to get the best price for my used car when I go into the cars, the sales lot or something like that. So hopefully the research has accomplished that.
Thanks, Jared. Great presentation. I'm wondering about the first experiment when you're looking at turnover or loyalty, I guess, and actual investor behavior rather than just hypothetical as in the second one. Yeah. Would there be a way to compare that to actual returns rather than hypothetical? How's their loyalty behave when the actual returns of the MMA fund might fall above or below the market, say, as a whole? Because I think, if I understood correctly, yours would be hypothetical questions.
Yeah.
If this, that might reveal a different set of behaviors than under just hypothetical, right?
Yeah. So in the survey, I can't collect how many assets they had at what particular time to get a sharp measure of where they were in the market and then compare that with actual data out there. So that's not something I pursued in this study, but I guess my first publication, 2011, I look at crisp mutual fund data, and I'm able to look at asset flows in and out of mutual funds, and I'm able to look at lagged return performance. So after a year of high return performance, people pile into the mutual funds that did well. After a bad year, they're coming out. And so I'm basically looking at the sensitivity of that lag return performance and the total net assets. And there I do find that I don't look at the Mennonite fund, I look at religious SRI assets, and I find that they appear to be more sticky. There's less of that back and forth in relation to the stock market movement than you see even in secular SRI funds, and certainly more than you see in conventional funds. And so that paper, I'm able to make a lot of comparisons that I'm not able to make in these studies because I'm looking at mutual fund data. So yes, I explored those ideas with a different data set where it's set up to look at those kinds of things.
I think you mentioned just kind of offhand that you didn't find a difference between conservatives and liberals on when you were trying to control for one variable, but did you ever find a difference in those two groups? Maybe were conservatives more concerned about the purity and the liberals more concerned about the being agents of change or something like that?
So it's been 5 years since I analyzed the Praxis data, but I'm pretty sure I didn't find an interaction there, that political conservatism and their knowledge of screening and advocacy didn't make an effect in my model. Otherwise, I would have published it, and that would, because I was looking for that, because this is all, the political landscape is important. So in that first study, I'm pretty confident there wasn't any effect that didn't help, but I would say in my in the experiment right now, I didn't present those results, but so this is the screening experiment, and I measure political conservativeness. And it basically, in both of those studies, if you're a political conservative, you're giving less to the social funds. Okay, so there's a significant effect for political conservatism, both when they read the screening and when they read the advocacy. And in both cases, if you're political conservative, you're not giving as much money to the social fund. So there is a political affiliation effect in these studies. I didn't make any predictions about it, so I didn't really highlight it because I really want to focus on the experimental conditions. But
so politically conservative means financially conservative. There's that, they're related in that sense.
Yeah, I think that would be a safe assumption, interpretation. Yeah.
One more. So I guess I have a bit more of a practical question because I'm a college student and I'm going to graduate soon and I'm interested in starting investing. So I've kind of looked at like socially responsible funds versus more mainstream funds. And then I'm trying to decide between, should I go with what kind of morally sounds the best, or should I go with something that maybe has better returns and then I have more money, which means maybe I can retire earlier and give more time to like church and charities and therefore have more money to give to charities. Like, where is the balance between the two? So I was just wondering if there's any sort of research of people that possibly choose more traditional or more mainstream funds with the intention of whatever benefit that brings, doing moral things with it.
Yeah, it's a great question. I don't know of research, but I certainly have heard that logic. I mean, like I said, there's many ways we meld our morality and our money together, and this is an example of one of them where I'm going to make as much money in the market as I can, and then I'm going to give a lot of it away to charity. That's kind of what the guy was saying at the very beginning, that cartoon. And I think a lot of corporate CEOs, corporations, people, the philanthropists that give a lot of money have made a lot of money in the market, and at the end of their life, they give a lot of it away. So we see that model, Carnegie, that's abundant in our society. So a lot of people think that's the way to do it. The first question you had, there was an assumption that you're not going to make as much money when you invest in these SRI funds. I don't think that's an awful assumption. A lot of empirical research is trying to answer that question. Can you do the right thing and be profitable at the same time? Or, can you profit from ethical behavior? Or on average, are you more likely to get a better return performance when you invest in these funds? And there's not really definitive evidence either way, right? If you do, there's hundreds of studies trying to look at this, and you get mixed results. Sometimes the better companies do well, sometimes the better companies don't do as well. And most of the time, it's a wash. You don't find any effect. And so I think that's kind of the empirical reality of whether by investing in SRI you get a better or worse return performance. I would caveat that if you're investing in places like Praxis or smaller mutual funds, you tend to have higher fees in these kinds of mutual funds if you're comparing it to an index Vanguard fund or something like that. But you're paying for people to do the advocacy work on your behalf. You're paying for them to do that those social things that you care about. So is that different than giving money to your church, dropping it in the basket and never seeing it again? Here, you know, you're dropping it into a fund and you're getting maybe 0.02 less return performance than you otherwise would, but maybe not. Maybe it's the same as you would get in a conventional fund. So I don't know. I don't really have a real clear answer of what you should do, but you know, you should think about it and do what seems right. There's no one way to behave morally in the market, I don't think. That would be kind of my take home.
That's helpful. Thank you.